Hello, everybody, and welcome. Sorry for the little bit of delay. It's been a little bit nuts in setting it up, but here we are. You're all here. We're here. Let's go. And considering what's going on everywhere, this makes perfect sense that there was absolute chaos to set this up. Now, I don't know about you, but over here, it's just massive chaos in all directions. Things are not working the way they should work, so everybody's disturbed. Everybody feels intense agitation in all respects. Something's wrong, and we're constantly trying to fix it. We're constantly trying to make it work right. Now, that's an interesting point. Make it work right. After all, what is right? Usually we think of it in terms of the way it always is. If things are the way they usually are, that's right. If things are changing everywhere, that's wrong. After all, change should be gradual and it should be for our benefit and it should be to increase whatever. Now, there's nothing absolute about this. It's just our idea of how things should be. But somehow the creation has another idea nowadays. Now, if we look at it from a detached point of view, we can say, yes, everything that was should be seen as right, but what if what was wrong? What if what we have defined as right is actually wrong? And if we are in charge of all existence, then whatever we decide should be what is, but it's not, so why? And if we're not in charge, why would existence care enough to make everything that we thought was right break down? Why would existence care? So I'm going to take a little, it's called a segue. We're going to make a little bit of a shift, and we'll get back to this in a second. So I've heard for a long time that Sri Dayananda Maharaj was translating or reconfiguring the presentation of the Mahabharata. And he's been working on this for quite some time. And he has figured out in the best way possible how to present things as close to the actual story of the Mahabharata as possible. Because various scholars, including all kinds of Vaishnava scholars, have complained about the Mahabharata as being very corrupt, the manuscript is not proper, that things have been added, things have been subtracted. It's quite chaotic. So he has spent a lot of time examining all of the manuscripts and trying to correlate with the Bhagavatam or other authorities, which are not corrupted, to make sense of the storyline of the Mahabharata. So this was done from the premise that Mahabharata means the history of Bharat, Bharatvasha, and that it should display the history and culture of the time as its primary activity, its primary function. So he's sticking to the storyline of the personalities who are very relevant to the history leading up to the battle of Kurukshetra about Krishna and all of that which we have come to know as the core and essence of the book. So I got an advanced copy of the manuscript. It is spectacular. I read it from cover to cover. It is absolutely wonderful. And what was most wonderful about it was that you could see the choices being made by all of the individuals in the history, depending on a point which was often overlooked when there was so much verbiage and other distracting things. Now, this is not a great revelation. It's nothing mind-bogglingly different or interesting. But the focus that I took from this was exactly on the concept of Dharma. Doing what is right according to Dharma. Now, I know that in the modified version of the way people see spiritualism in the Vaishnava culture. Dharma is seen as less important because Krishna said, just give up all forms of Dharma, surrender to him, and that's the only thing that's important. But the only reason that works is because there are individuals within the context of Dharma who are creating the foundation upon which everything rests. But that's the way it's supposed to be. It is not that way now, and hasn't been that way for quite some time. Because we modern people are very expert at rationalizing our choices. Somebody may do something wrong, and when challenged on it, he or she rationalizes it in such a way by saying that, well, I had to do it because of. And that is one big excuse. One uses an excuse to say why one does not follow Dharma. And one sees after a while it becomes a pattern. The pattern is many excuses to explain why one is doing what one is doing up to the point where one just does whatever one feels is best. So what was happening that when I was reading the book, I was just amazed at how every single decision, every single choice, every single consideration followed Dharma. The devas, the suras, those who are the divine personalities, those who are leaders, those who are kings, those who are brahmanas, everybody followed Dharma except the asuras. The asuras followed Dharma only to make a result for themselves, which was a Dharma. For example, the son of the king's son was an asura. Everybody knew an asura had taken birth as the grandson of the king. And everybody knew the whole point of him taking birth was to take over the kingdom for the asuras. Everyone knew this. So when I say everybody knew this, I meant amongst the royal family. Now, according to self-interest, the easiest thing to do, according to that logic, is to just kill the asura or pick him up and send him to the other side of the planet. I mean, obvious, right? Wrong. Because Dharma did not allow the killing of the rightful heir to the throne. He had a right to do that because he took birth there. And you could read in all the discussions where they're trying to figure out what to do to protect the kingdom, to protect the people. Every single thing they considered was within Dharma. They never considered doing something else. Because they said, if we do not follow Dharma, we are no better than the asuras. If we do not follow Dharma, we are going to cause the destruction of prosperity in the kingdom. Because without Dharma, there is no peace. Without Dharma, there is no prosperity. Without Dharma, there is no connection to the divine. I'm only talking about one thing. Every single part of the story, every single action that is taken, every bit of it is Dharma. Even their seeing the asuras undermine their efforts, they don't change the structure, they don't make decisions based on self-interest. So one may say, well, what is Dharma? That's an obvious question. What is Dharma? I'm sure every one of you know perfectly well what it is, right? Well, maybe you do. I'm not going to say you don't. But when you're a king, or you are a prince, or you're in the royal family, or you are a brahmana, or you are somebody who's so much depending on Dharma, you have to know it in detail. And from the point of view of the Kshatriya race, from the point of view of the leadership, it is very much based in the value of protection of the kingdom, of the people, protection of the brahmanas, protection of the divine understanding of existence. And when we speak about that, what really is the underlying principles here? And now we're talking about things we have talked about a lot, which is the value structure, morality, ethics, care for others, protection of others, making sure that your decisions are not rooted in self-interest to the detriment of others, and maintaining the order of things, because there is a reason for every order. Now, for us in the modern times, we have lost all connection to Dharma because we are not sheltered by learned brahmanas. We are not sheltered by devoted kshatriyas. We are just living in a world of money-making existence where everybody's doing whatever they can for themselves. But in those days, they had a very defined structure which was given to them as a universal principle. This Varnashram Dharma, that comes from God. And that's why even today you see this division of activity. You see the principles working on a very surface level and rather deeply as well. But what we see underneath it all is there are those with money who manipulate what brahmanas say or do, or manipulate the leaders, or those who think themselves the leaders who are manipulating everybody. And therefore, we are living in a time of adharma. And because we are living in this time, everything is agitated. You cannot have peace and everybody feeling protected and prosperous without Dharma. So therefore, everything that is done, the choices that are made, are agitating the energy of the world more and more. And therefore, we are all becoming more agitated in the head, agitated in the heart. Personal relationships are breaking down. Families are breaking down. And we see how there is this feeling of we've got to do something, yet what? And then the story was about also Satyavati. And if you know anything about the history, she's one of the most important personalities. And every decision she's making, she is struggling to do everything according to Dharma, yet at the same time, do what is best for the whole kingdom. And we could also see that those who are in power, not her necessarily at that time, but those who are in power, those who have the ability to influence, are that constantly struggling with making things work, with balancing things according to the principles of Dharma. So then the next question is obviously, well, what do we do now? What can we do about this situation? Well, first of all, it would be very presumptuous of me to sit here and think I can say something that'll help solve the situation. I mean, what I could do is try to encourage us to make small changes in our own lives, or if we have any possibility to influence others to make small changes in their lives, to do what is right. I mean, the problem really is that, well, what power do we have? What possibility do we have? Ultimately, how are we going to make a difference? Now, somebody can say, well, you know, you just go around and preach to everybody, and, you know, tell them to join the Hare Krishnas and everything will be fine. But do we follow Dharma? Or are we just doing whatever we think is right according to whatever fits? Can you create a society without following Dharma that is actually going to accomplish some meaningful change in the world? That's a very interesting question. What if you, for example, really spread a lot of chanting and a lot of preaching? Super good things, okay, sure, why not? But you don't institute it within a leadership that follows Dharma. What would happen? Well, you already know. Don't need me to tell you. And yet at the same time, what can one do? You know, when you think about all of these great personalities who took up leadership in those days, they all shared one thing in common. A very significant system of education where they learned exactly what they should do and what they should not do and how to do it. For example, Satyavati grew up in a fishing village. She was not of that. She was actually born of a king, but that's another part of the story. She grew up in the fishing village, hidden away, and she went across the river and learned from very great brahmanas. So the whole thing hung on, depended on that training, that educational system where all of these leaders learned exactly what they were supposed to do. They didn't have to figure it out. They didn't have to speculate or trial and error and, you know, ask other people's opinions. They learned. This is what has to be done. I mean, obviously, you need to adapt these principles. You need to make choices based on these principles in all kinds of a variety of situations, which you never learned specifically. And that is the point of education, to give people a proper structure within which they can figure out how to act under the principles of Dharma. But to do that, you need to have brahmanas who know that. So that becomes even more interesting. It seems everything is based on Brahminical culture. But we're not talking about just library forms of academia, writing papers and so on. We're talking about those who actually understand how existence works. I mean, therefore, to have such experts who are immersed in the principles of Dharma and at the same time aware of the application of that in the various forms of reality is absolutely essential for creating proper society. And it's interesting, if you know the way in which various groups have tried throughout previous hundreds of years to create very special schools just for this purpose, you will see that we, quote unquote, are not the only ones who've understood this. There are many elite schools, elite academies, even hidden, some more public, where leaders are churned out and behind the scenes powers place them into various positions. Yet, how many of these are not self-interested, but are interested in the actual welfare of the world and of society? Very hard to say, but how many of them are educated in Dharma? Very hard to say. I mean, you ask anybody, please explain the principles of Dharma in relationship to leadership. It's going to be really hard to get a good answer, because that devotional knowledge which is based in Dharma is so pushed aside in the background of existence that you can't even get it out of the Mahabharata because it's been so twisted and so lost and so speculated into something else. So I think it's going to take multiple generations of really trying to reestablish these principles before we really accomplish what we wish to accomplish. But in the meantime, we have some very basic principles like protection of children, protection of women, protection of old people. This is straight out of any shastra. These very basic principles of protection of the peace, protection of order, to give people facility and possibilities to establish themselves in this world. So there's a lot of work to do, but if at least one has the right idea of what it is that has to be done, there's at least a possibility that eventually, in some point in time, something of value may be established. Therefore, I'm a fan of education. But even more importantly, I'm a fan of educating educators. And even more importantly, I'm a fan of figuring out how to educate the educators by preparing the literatures which make the codes by which educators are educated. And what's interesting is when you take away the noise that is there in literatures from ancient times, and you stick to the principles, the essence of it, in the way that Hridayananda Maharaj did in that Mahabharata, everything, I think, can be found there, or at least a way. So, if there are any questions, or there are already, all kinds of questions. Okay, so I'm going to take a little break right now. Oh, piles of questions. What do we have? Oh my God, so many questions. I guess I said something good today. Or agitating. I'll read it. Number 1.1. As you might have heard, some Russian researchers believe that in light of the fact that the Bharat Varsha spread throughout almost the entire continent of Eurasia up to the time of Kurukshetra, the places described in the text of the Mahabharata were not exactly on the territory of India. So there is a place in Russia that such researchers associate with Kurukshetra. This is the Kursk Bulge and the plain in the vicinity of the city of Kursk. And Hastinapur, city of elephants, they correlate with the city of Hosting. But that's not all. They think elephants are mammoths, and in the area of these places, mass graves of mammoth bones are found. But that's not all. They think elephants were mammoths. And in the area, that's 1.2, of these places, mass graves of mammoth bones were found indeed. These researchers, including some contactees who communicate with Krishna outside the Vaishnava tradition, even attribute the very place of Krishna's appearance and his childhood games not to the territory of Vrindavan in India, which we know today as such thanks to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, but the Russian city of Lipetsk. They have their own arguments, most of which are topological and linguistic in nature. The names of ancient rivers and cities on the territory of Russia. We just want to know your opinion about all of this, if possible. Oh yeah, thanks heaps. Mahayurup. Well, I can tell you straight out, I have no idea. Me personally, I don't know. I don't study this stuff. I haven't talked to anybody about this stuff. So I have no opinion. You ask, your only question is, what's my opinion? And I have no opinion. Well, but I do agree that the area that is spoken of in this entire history, and even previous to that, in more quote-unquote Vedic times, definitely was in a much larger area than just India, for sure. But where everything was exactly, I don't know. maybe what they're saying is correct to some extent, or maybe it's very correct. I really have no idea. But it's fun to research such stuff. That for sure. It's fun and it's useful. So it should be done. I mean, this is probably not at all the answer you were looking for, but it's all I got from last week. It's all I got. Okay, number two. How do you personally see the real ways of developing Brahminical culture in modern society? Well, I see that to develop Brahminical culture, you first have to develop Brahmanas. To develop Brahmanas, you have to first develop the materials or the information and the educational system that will develop the Brahmanas. It doesn't matter in what way you see it, that's the only way to go. To develop a culture, you have to create the circumstances and surroundings within which that culture can develop. And I think that to practically do this, you need to create an institution. You need to have enough money to finance proper educators and allow them to develop themselves without worrying about money or positions or anything, so that they can teach others. So it's a question of financing, it's a question of location, and it's a question of attracting others to just focus on that. But then the next issue would be, well, yeah, but then what? So now you've got like this institution, you've got like these people, let's just assume, and they're able to teach. So who are they going to teach? And that brings up a very interesting issue. Can Brahminical culture exist independently of a functioning Varnashram structure? Because after all, Brahmana is one of the four Varnas. So how are you going to know who's a Brahmana if you don't have like the four Varnas to discriminate who's who, where in that structure they lie? And here comes the frustration. You can't even do Varnashram Dharma in the institution that's supposed to be most attracted to it, ISKCON. So by definition, the concept of establishing Brahminical culture is dead in the water. That does not mean you shouldn't try. It just means you need to try understanding these limitations. And to establish your educational system, taking into account, you're going to have a lot of variegated personalities attempting to become highly evolved Brahmanas. And maybe out of this many, you know, I have my hands in the air, if you're listening, you don't know, maybe out of this many, whatever size that is, you may get a small amount of them who actually succeed. Yeah, but then what? Well, just the fact that you're trying, and just the fact that you're somewhat even succeeding, is enough to get the snowball rolling down that hill. Snowy hill. I mean, if you think about it, Christianity was just some small, tiny thing until a great leader decided this is good stuff. So sometimes what one has to do is just do what one does as best one can until one is recognized by someone who has the power to make it bigger. More than that, I really haven't proceeded in my figuring out. That's it. You got it. That's the end. Period. And the next part of that question is, what is my personal definition of Dharma? And what does it mean in a practical sense for a modern person? Well, first of all, me having a personal opinion or definition of something like Dharma is not important. For me to have a definition, my own personal definition of Dharma, is a Dharma. It is not the way Dharma is. Dharma is, and I Learn it. Follow it. There's a difference. But in this lecture, I very much focused on the way in which these leaders in that time only made choices that were of following the Dharma, regardless of the personal consequences. That is also my personal definition, because I embrace the same definition, because that is the definition. But then the second part of the question, what does it mean practically for a modern person? Well, are you talking about a modern person who is underneath those who are making the decisions as leaders? Or are you talking about a modern person who is trying to be such a leader? It's a different situation. I mean, obviously, there's much more to Dharma than the essence of the particular history I was talking about. But the same Dharma applies to the same principles of the Dharma applies to modern people in the same way, who are attaining to be leaders. So when we speak about principles, when we speak about these values, when we speak about these fundamental understandings of what is right, that applies throughout time, because you're not talking about anything specific in relationship to time, place, and circumstance. You're talking about principles. And I think that the principles of Dharma are very practical, because you do what you do because you feel you should do it. And what makes you feel you should do it is your choice and your desire, which, if it's based in Dharma, that's practical for you. The how you do it based in Dharma determines your choice, determines your desires. That's practical. And number three, Samfartika believes that genuine cultural education should go hand in hand with the healing of society, each of its members. Yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, obviously, healing is absolutely essential, especially nowadays when there's just so many wounds and trauma everywhere. The earth is feeling it. The atmosphere is feeling it. All the creatures are feeling it. And especially human beings are just continually absorbed in it. Next question is not very easy to answer. How do you feel? Well, it's easy to answer how I feel. But the question is, how do you feel about Manu and Vishnu Smriti and Dharma Shastras? Is it possible to study the basic principles of Dharma from there or from within them? Well, if I were to be tasked, which I'm not, but if I were to be tasked to figuring out how to write down or encapsulate the principles of Dharma from these literatures, I would go about it in a very specific way. I would pick out each particular section that refers to a principle of Dharma and extract from the story or extract from the culture exactly what that principle is in as few words as possible, just so that it's really clear. Then I would organize them into a list according to categories, and I would double check against literatures which we have more faith in, for example, Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, just for example. And I would make sure there's nothing in there which sounds really off. And then I would try to find more references in other places that amplify these principles in a way which is acceptable, but which is also useful, but which is also compatible with our modern existence. And I think that would be a really cool project. Because educational institutions should also be research institutions. So this is the way in which the people within that educational institution, including students, can do research to expand their knowledge. I think that'd be very cool. Okay, next question. Doesn't seem to have a number from G. It is said that there are 5 types of relationship with Krishna, rasas. So my question is, Do these relationships develop from one to the other, or are souls created with a specific rasa once and for all? And if there is a progress, then how do these evolving souls exist on different levels in the spiritual world forever? Or these relationships develop only for born beings of this world? I'm going to answer this in two parts. Number one, I don't believe, and I have never read, that relationships, that you go through these rasas like that, one after another. Part one. Part two, let's think about what rasa actually is. Rasa is that relationship that develops between ourselves and Krishna. So let's look at any relationship that we have experience of. Well, the relationship, first of all, depends on two. Now, Krishna is not evolving in that way. So Krishna adapts in the relationship according to who we are. And so the most important point is we are. When I say, for example, I am, that is my existence, my energy, my consciousness, my being. And the process of coming to know that in full is a process of accepting what I am. Now that assumes I am something. For example, if one was believing in the impersonalist form of things, one would say maybe I am, but then I have to become something to engage in rasa. So therefore, just being is superior to becoming, and therefore the impersonal form of understanding is superior. But that's circular reasoning. If one understands I am, one understands I am, and that is the entirety of my existence. I don't have to become anything. I already am. And how would that manifest? So if I am in relationship, in other words, any form of relationship, even physical proximity or devotional proximity or with the deity or through the literature or the holy name or whatever form of that proximity, when I come in relationship like that, Krishna will interact with me according to what I am. So Krishna is acting towards me according to what I am, and I am reciprocating with Krishna according to what I am, because I have no other possibility. I mean, which being in the proximity of Krishna is going to act like something they're not? That was another interesting thing from the Mahabharata, that whenever Satyavati wanted to find out if somebody was an asura or not, it's part of the story, she would ask them what they thought about Vishnu, and if they were devoted to Vishnu, because the asuras can never say they're devoted to Vishnu. It's just not possible for them. And so, because Krishna is all attractive and so powerful, if we were to come in association, instantly we would act as we are. In any one of these relationships that we are, it's not that we have to become it. The spiritual evolution is to get to the point of being in proximity with Krishna so this can happen, not that you have to go through rasas as if one was better than the other. So actually, I like that question because I liked being able to give that answer. Okay, 5.5. I wonder why we have points there, but okay. At the very beginning, you said that without Dharma, there is no connection with the divine. What principles of Dharma do you consider necessary to establish contact with divine energy? And is there a feedback link, the formation of Dharma through the manifestation of divine energy in the lives of specific people? Okay, it's strangely worded, but what I think it means in the second part is that if you have come in contact with divine energy, would that inspire Dharma within you, inspire you to act in a certain way according to Dharma? I mean, obviously that would be so. When one asks what principles of Dharma are necessary to establish contact with divine energy, well, I mean, how could you establish contact with divine energy if you didn't have that understanding of choice, of values, of if you weren't acting in a very much goodness manner for the sake and welfare of others, you wouldn't be able to connect to divine energy. I don't believe, well, when you say contact with divine energy, that's very vague, because contact can be even in very subtle ways, in very slight ways, which would make what I'm saying less relevant. But if I were to say connection to the deity or connection to God, or without Dharma, it would be very difficult. And there's another question here about films, like films about the Mahabharata, films about the Ramayana. Yeah, but these are more Hollywood than they are Shastra. I mean, you would not learn from a film in the same way, I don't think, especially modern ones. And besides, I haven't really seen that many. I mean, I saw in India in the 70s, early 70s, there were some films which we went to see, we all went like this. Okay, here's number 7. Can nonviolence, ahimsa, in all its senses and manifestations be considered the basis of Dharma? No. Because, the culture of having proper kings and proper protection, and it's very much based on the having the power to establish it. It's not based in ahimsa. Ahimsa, it is one of the principles of Dharma as a overriding principle, yes, because you don't want to harm if you don't have to. Oh, wait, I know, Sita, you're doing the questions, aren't you? Okay, so when you do the point one, does that mean it's from the same person and it's related? Okay, now I got it. So you should tell me these things. Anyway, okay. Number 9. I have the impression that in order for the political elites of the world to change towards caring for the welfare of society, global catalysms must occur so that global ties are destroyed and communities are localized and concentrated on local resources, human, natural, economic, and others. Because it is globalization, as you have already said, that has brought society out of today's situation. I don't know what that means, but it means probably created today's situation. This is kind of like chicken and which came first, the chicken or the egg. But we know for sure that cataclysms are very much a product of our choices, amongst other factors. And many of the choices are based in making a lot of money, which is a very global concern nowadays and has been always. And it's also assumed that if there's a localized society, we won't have the problems we have now. That's assumed. Is that true? Well, first of all, you won't know for sure until it actually happens, but then it's too late. If we look back in history, when the world was in localized communities like this, can we say it was peaceful and working towards the welfare of everybody? If you read histories of these times in the past, you'll see like different tribes attack different tribes for different reasons, and there's all kinds of slaughter of of tribes and civilizations come, civilizations go, being wiped out in this way and that way. It wasn't peaceful. Yeah, but it's also obvious that localization is a much more stable and secure socioeconomic structure than globalization. But each has its own particular part. If you can have one within the other, it makes a lot more sense. So I can probably say with great conviction that probably say with great conviction, what a silly thing. But I could probably get away with saying that I don't think that globalization per se or localization per se brings about the solution. The solution is in people and the way in which we make our choices and values rather than simply some external structure. Number 10, but Chaitanya Mahaprabhu pointed out exactly where Vrindavan, and not only where Vrindavan was, but visited all the Vedic places in India, at least most of them. I mean, yeah, I'm not going to believe just because somebody in Russia decides Vrindavan's in Russia, that Vrindavan's in Russia. I mean, I'm on the camp of, well, you know, where Lord Chaitanya went is fine by me. I'm okay with that. But you know, some maybe in these other places, there was some form of Vedic culture. Just, I wouldn't start saying, that's Vrindavan up there. Where is it? What did you call it? Lipetsk or whatever. Number 11, what subject should be taught to people in the educational system? How about a little question at the end of the lecture? I mean, exclusively based on the Shastras or even on the knowledge of the achievements of civilization, which can be very useful for proper education? I mean, obviously, if you're going to establish an educational structure within a Vaishnava culture of some kind, you're obviously going to include all the Vaishnava knowledge that you have. I mean, obviously. And if you want to be really relevant, you're going to have to reach into all of the aspects of history, reach into discussions, reach into the research that has been done before, and integrate that in a way so that the student is very informed, very well-rounded, and aware of what they are doing. 12. Isn't one of the pillars of Dharma the worship of devas, gods, besides the Almighty? Yes and no. I would not use the words that are used in this question. I would say that obviously Dharma includes recognizing these devas who are the representatives of Vishnu and through whom all of the benefits of our existence here are obtained, like the food, the water, the air, the nature, and so on, fire. So yes, you mentioned rasa. Now there are different opinions in the worldwide devotee community about which highest rasa to Krishna should be sought in life. My question is, does this matter at all, or is this more of an individual question like so many things in life? Number 13. Yeah, when somebody starts speaking about seeking out a rasa, sought, I say, gee, you don't really know how it works. And if one uses words like highest rasa, I'm like, gee, you know, that's not the way it works. If one is into highest and seeking, then you gotta be a gopi. You gotta be a gopi, you gotta be a brahmana, you gotta be a sannyasi, guru, GBC, BBT, blah, blah, blah. You gotta be the highest, you gotta go upward mobility. It's all upward mobility till you get to the top, and then you dominate. So none of these things have anything to do in reality with who you are, I mean spiritually, and your connection to God, to Krishna. That's just my opinion. Take it for what it's worth. Well, we had a lot of questions today, and I'm very impressed. All the questions are good. And I thank you all very much for being here and for giving me the opportunity to, you know, feel like I have some meaning in this world. And may you all be well and happy and healing, and big hugs and love to all of you, and bye. And thank you. Bye. See you again.